Welcome to the Lavo Show podcast. Conversations with outstanding human beings whose love has been inspired and transformed by Osho. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and thanks for tuning in. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Parambodhi. Parambodhi is a long-term Osho sannyasin and lives with Osho since 1980. Parambodhi travels extensively around the world and currently lives in India. I'm so happy to have Parambodhi on the show and I hope you enjoyed. Parambodhi, welcome to the show. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Enjoying India in the monsoon.
To start, Parambodhi, tell us a little bit about you and your story before meeting Osho.
I was born in Australia. Grew up on a farm in northern New South Wales, not far from Byron Bay, which is where many of the sannyasins live in Australia now. And when I left school, I moved to Sydney, studied nursing for a while, psychiatric nursing, and eventually got into hairdressing. I didn't finish high school. I've never been, interested in study. I was more interested just in experiencing life, I guess you could say, even at that time. And I started hearing about, I moved to Perth when I was in my early 20s, and Perth had a big Osho community. So I started seeing people in red and malas walking around the streets, and I had a client who had her show on the ABC television, and she came back from Pune at one point and was a sannyasin with a mala, and left her job and moved back to Pune. And I was thinking, oh wow, these people that somehow are quite attractive in their energy, and not just wayward hippies, but actually quite substantial people. So that sort of piqued my interest a bit, and I wrote the address of the ashram down, and when I started traveling, I ended up in Pune. The rest is history, as they say.
Okay, so that was 1980, correct?
That was 1980, yes.
Did you stay with Osho all the rest of the time?
No. Shortly after I arrived in Pune, my father got very sick, and my mother asked me to come home. So I did. I come from a background that, I was never interested in meditation. I was never interested in, gurus or spirituality. I went really just to Pune on a whim. And when Osho walked into the hall on that first, the energy in Pune was just incredible. And he walked into the hall on that first morning, and it was like, I don't know, it was just overwhelmed with just the energy, and his energy was really palpable. You could feel it. It affected you. I mean, I understand why, outsiders, the press often call us brainwashed or, drugged, because it was like, almost like taking a drug. His energy in the physical, in the Buddha field was very, very strong. And it was so powerful that all I wanted to do was just stay there, without really understanding who he was or what he was or what meditation was or what enlightenment was. I knew nothing. I was just completely overwhelmed and in love, fell in love. Yeah. So after a short time, I went back to Australia. But back in Australia, all I wanted was to get back to Pune. So as soon as I could, I moved back to Pune and was there for the last 4 or 5 months before he went to America.
And then did you follow the sannyasins in Oregon? Have you lived in America in the ranch?
Initially, I went back to Australia, got involved in a small community in the Northern Rivers near a place called Nimbin. And then when Arup and Sushila, who are now Arup, who is now Garimo, they were traveling around the world and letting people know what was happening with Osho, where he was, that they had bought a ranch and the commune was being started. So it was a big gathering in Sydney. And we all went down, and I ended up spending a month with the two women and traveled around Australia with them. And at the end of that tour, they invited me to come to the ranch. The ranch was very small in that first year, so you couldn't just turn up. You had to be invited. There was very little accommodation. In summertime, people lived in tents, but in winter, you know, the temperature got, you know, down to minus 30, minus, I think the lowest I ever saw it was minus 32 in winter. So you had to have indoor accommodation. So in wintertime, anybody that didn't have proper housing had to leave. So it was, I got an invitation and went to Europe initially for a few months and helped organize the first annual World Celebration, and arrived in the ranch in July, the beginning of July, or actually I think it was the end of June for the celebration, and then stayed from then until very late in 85.
Okay, great. So, I mean, you have been with Sannyasin and Osho for a long time. Essentially, you had some breaks here and there, but overall, you have lived the life in the Osho communes for years.
Initially, before he left the body, for about 10 years. It was like 1980, late 1980 to, until he left the body. Pernatu was very different because it wasn't really a commune anymore. People came and left. There wasn't that much accommodation inside the ashram. So people came and left, and you participated, you know, in life, you know, either you had an apartment or a room, or and you came and went, you know, in the evening. So the ranch was, you know, a commune where we all lived together, we ate together. But Pernatu changed in that there wasn't a lot of accommodation initially, and so people just rented apartments and rented houses and lived together and came to the ashram on a daily basis. But yes, for that 10 years, I was really mostly, you know, around Osho in the communes and traveling in Europe. I spent time in the European communes, Puna 1, the ranch, Puna 2.
Clearly, you're a seasoned sannyasin and you've got lots of experience. So, and I'd like to jump to the main topic of today's episode, which is, for me, a very relevant topic, I think, because it's not very much talked about, and it's about being gay and sannyasin, Osho sannyasin. First of all, can you give us a sense of the gay sannyasin scene during Osho's time? Were there many gay people around Osho?
When you talk about a scene, that it sort of makes it sound like, you know, what the gay scene is like in the outside world. There was no scene as such. We were sannyasins, and I think, you know, the whole point of being a sannyasin is to drop your identification. So there was quite a few, you know, men and women who were attracted to the same sex, but there was no scene as such. In Puna 1, before Osho went into silence, he spoke very positively about homosexuality. I have many quotes, which I could send you if you're interested. One of the main ones that, you know, always was very strong for me was he said that it was a Darshan question, I think it was, and he was answering somebody who had asked, will being gay in any way affect, my, ability to, you know, become enlightened or to, you know, in that sense. And he said, absolutely not. the only thing that will inhibit your enlightenment or your chance of enlightenment is to live falsely or not live who you are. So it's irrelevant whether you're gay or straight or male or female. You have to be who you are. And then he was in silence for 3.5 years. And then when he came out of silence, the HIV epidemic had reared its ugly, you know, head. And so in the new phase of his talking, he spoke very negatively about homosexuality. But in my understanding, you know, he wasn't talking about the individual or the essence of the people. He was hitting at the identification of homosexuality. And there was a very real danger at that time in the mid-80s. There was no understanding of the illness and how it was manifesting, how it was passed on, where it came from, how it affected the long-term life. People were dying. And our community was a very sexually active community, so he came down hard and introduced condoms initially, safe sex practices, and I think that was what saved the community because it didn't really spread into the wider community. The people who were HIV positive were isolated, and so therefore, you know, there wasn't any more transmission of the virus. He was ridiculed by especially the American press at that time for introducing condoms, but it's really what saved the community. And unfortunately, it's left a feeling that he was homophobic, which absolutely, in my experience, he was not. I remember a time in one of the discourses at the ranch still, I think it was in 85, and he said something about, he was being interviewed by a reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle, and the reporter was asking about the homosexuals who were living at the ranch and in connotation with what he was saying about homosexuality. And he said, just point blank, yes, these people need to change. They need to become, you know, drop these ways and become heterosexual. I mean, these are my words. I'm not quoting him. These are my words in the essence of what he said. He said they have to change, and if they don't change, they have to leave. That was a very strong statement. And there was one person in particular. For me, when I heard him say that, it was a strong statement, but I thought he's not talking about me. He couldn't be talking about me, surely, because it just didn't feel like this was not, yeah, it didn't feel right for me. But somebody got very upset about it and wrote an angry letter to him. And he had Hasio, who was his secretary at the time, call all of the people who were gay at the ranch together for a meeting. And he said absolutely clearly through Hasio, I'm not going to change what I'm saying publicly, but don't take it personally. And that was really, I felt like, okay, I had understood, you know, when I heard the quote, when I heard him say that, I had understood that he wasn't speaking to the individual. He was hitting hard because he thought, he understood that the HIV crisis was a very, very serious crisis and it was going to, you know, end up affecting and killing a lot of people.
There is so much to kind of expand and explore, and you mentioned so very interesting points here. I'd love to pick up on the fact that Osho was so intelligent, and when the AIDS issue came up, he was so quick to act and put in place these preventative measures.
Yes, he saved the community.
And as you said,
we were using condoms from, I think, early 84.
And it's so forward thinking, you know, even nowadays in some countries, this is not even happening. All the governments in the developed countries, they encourage the measures that OSHA implemented in the mid-80s. So.
Yes, exactly.
That's one point I'd like to highlight because there's so much misunderstanding there as well. And then also I wanted to thank you for clarifying and picking on my terminology, sannyasins, because just shows that you are thinking of yourself as an individual and as a sannyasin, a spiritual seeker, as a soul, and that's probably Osho's work. It's good that, you know, there is a tendency of the mind and my tendency to categorize and put people into different places, and that's just
yes, I think that's normal.
and it's beautiful to break that at any opportunities. And then what I've noticed myself, because I've listened, obviously, as you can imagine, for 20 years I've listened to Osho discourses and read many books, and I've come across different quotes of Osho on homosexualities in different contexts. And I've noticed myself a huge discrepancies. And sometimes in private discourses, he was the most supportive master, whereas in some other public statements after Oregon, as you mentioned, he was quite strong and very negative about homosexuality. So how did you cope with those shocking statements back then? And how do you cope with that now?
He was really hitting at the conditioning of, you know, I'm a gay person, or I'm a homosexual, or I'm male, I'm female, I'm heterosexual. He always hit at the conditioning. I'm Jewish, I'm Indian, I'm Hindu. I think that first hit when what I spoke about at the ranch, and I felt like it was a strong statement, and I didn't feel like he was speaking to me personally. So when that was emphasized later, you know, in the meeting with Hasio, I realized that I had gotten the point. Later in Pune 2, in 87, he was continuing to hit very hard. And I felt some troubling sort of rumblings going on inside of me. You know, how can this be? I had had, you know, I mean, I most of my life I've had male partners, but I've also had girlfriends. I've had, you know, deep love affairs with women, but just not particularly a strong sexual drive with women, or not really a sexual drive. But when my heart is deeply engaged with a woman, the sexuality will move, but it's not a strong energy. So in 87, you know, he was hitting hard, quite hard. You know, again, every sort of third or fourth discourse, there would be some very strong statement in relation to homosexuality. And, you know, I started looking, you know, what does this mean to me? What am I? Who am I? You know, how can I change? Is it possible to change? And so I asked him, I started writing some questions to him, and he didn't answer them. And then I talked to Garimo about it, and she said, well, he obviously doesn't want to answer it publicly, so write to him privately. So I wrote a personal question, and that he answered. And again, he was very clear. And the question was, beloved Osho, I hear what you're saying about homosexuality. I understand it. But my energy clearly is towards men. So you also say, don't repress your desires. So what do I do with that energy? How to transform that energy? You know, I really don't understand where to go with it. And his reply was, it doesn't matter. You don't need to be with women. You be with men. There's no problem at all. And just bring your awareness to your lovemaking. That was as simple as that. And I remember Neil brought me the answer, and the tears, she had tears in her eyes as she was telling me, because she said her mind interpreted, you know, when she took the question to him, her mind was saying, oh, well, you know, he's going to, you know, give such an answer. And she said his compassion and his love was so deep, and she started crying when she was telling me this. So I think privately, you know, he was saying something very different. And publicly, I think he was just, he had his own reasons. And I think it was really the HIV epidemic. Perhaps, you know, in 87, 88, it was still not known in the medical world how serious the disease was. Everybody was still dying. There was no medicine. There was no real medicine to keep alive. That didn't really change until the 90s. And now in the 2000s, early in the last 3 or 4 years, the medication has changed so drastically that if you do have HIV and you're on medication, you cannot pass the virus on. So it's a huge difference between now and then when he was saying those things. And he left the body and it never really got changed. So unfortunately, you know, I can understand why people think that he was homophobic. And gay people, yes, I have people write to me many times online, on Facebook, and they've fallen in love with Osho. As you said, your friend, we didn't talk about it, we talked about it before the interview. Your friend in London, how he was confused because, you know, he fell in love with Osho. And then he hears Osho condemning homosexuality and it creates confusion. But I think it's really the identification. It has to be, can only be the identification with being this or being that, that is going to create that confusion. Because his love and compassion is for all of humanity. He's not singling out one section of humanity to be bad. He never really hit the individual. Unless it was a disciple who was close, who was, you know, more of a Zen hit. So, yeah, it is, I know, it has created a lot, and it's also created a lot of homophobia, you know, in the world, because people who read Osho and hear those statements, if they have homophobic energy, then it gives them license to feel that their views correct. So when he makes jokes about, you know, Jewish people, people think that he's anti-Jewish, but, you know, he's not anti-Jewish. He's anti perhaps identification of people who are Jewish. He's anti, you know, identification of people who are Catholic or Christian or Hindu or American or Australian, because we're one humanity. We're one. You know, we're not separate. We don't have separate identities. We have maybe different personalities and we have separate bodies. But in essence, I understand, my understanding, we're one. Okay?
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, that's very beautifully said. And I thank you for that, because it's very powerful that comes from you and brings so much clarity to a very complex topic. And I think if we look at this in the context of identification, that makes so much more sense, because it's true. I mean, if you listen to Osho, he was taking a piece out of so many different categories, you know, and the homosexual one is a very sensitive one, but perhaps the Jewish is even more sensitive, considering, you know, the history of what Jew people have been through. And in fact, I have some Jew people who are shocked, you know, even though they love Osho, they still can't recover yes. from some of the jokes he made about the Jewish, which is shocking. I mean, the man publicly had the courage to say those things, and, you know, it's so politically incorrect. But the point is not to offend the Jewish people, is to, as you say, to break that conditioning. And he made so many jokes against the Catholic, against the Pope, against the Polish, against, you know.
I don't think there was anyone.
Exactly. He didn't spare anyone. Including Indians.
Including India.
So just to summarize, that discrepancy between what Osho was saying on a personal level to individual gay sannyasins and what were his public statements. So what you're saying is that we need to look at these public statements about homosexuality in the context of the 80s and the issue with AIDS. Because at the time, if I'm not wrong,
yes,
I think
that's what I think.
There was a huge implication that the virus was spread because homosexual sex.
Yes, definitely up until the mid-80s. It's not really known. It was very unknown whether it would be passed on with sneezing, with sex. Definitely it was being passed on with sex, but, you know, there was a fear it was going to be passed on, you know, with sneezing or with mosquito bites. Definitely syringe, you know, needles, people that got blood transfusion. But yes, it wasn't, there was no understanding of the scientific nature of the virus. And people were dying. A lot of people were dying. So it was very fearful. People were very fearful of it. And it spread through the homosexual community first. But then when they started to see that hemophiliacs also got the virus, and then women started getting it more and more, that it wasn't, you know, specific to homosexuals. But initially it was. And I think that's where the misunderstanding came in. There was no scientific understanding in those early years of what was happening with the virus. And I don't know, you know, I wasn't close enough to Osho to know, you know, if he was, there was no internet, so he wasn't able to do his own research. So he was being given information that was out there, which was scientifically incorrect at that time. And he was acting on that. I mean, when he first started talking about the virus, he said that 2/3 of humanity were going to die from this virus. Well, that didn't happen, but it was certainly, you know, very, very serious. And he really wanted to get the point across and make it clear to us that we needed to protect ourselves. His statements and his insights on the matter were really to protect us. I feel that very strongly, to protect his community and protect humanity.
Before our interview, we were just chatting and I was sharing with you that I've lived in London for many years. Some gay friends I had, they also were interested in Osho. And particularly there was one guy who was totally blown away and he came to our meditation classes and then he was in love with Osho, but he was torn inside. He was really struggling and he sometimes would get so angry and he would kind of question me and say, well, look at what Osho said here. How is it possible? How do you justify this? And obviously I have, you know, I'm not here to justify Osho, protect Osho, explain Osho, you know, Osho is Osho and he said what he said and it's not my responsibility to do that, but in light of what you just clarified, what would be your advice to gay men or lesbian women who loves Osho but feels this inner struggle about what Osho said in some of those public statements?
You know, the identification can only be dropped through, you know, understanding yourself and really looking, who am I? Who am I? That question, who am I? What am I? Am I a body? Am I a man? Am I a woman? Am I gay? Am I straight? And I think if you look deeply at those questions, you know, we're not any of those things. We're an essence. That's what I believe. That's what I feel. I did a lot of work on myself in Path of Love, the process that's run by Rafia and Taria. And I came to the understanding and the realization that, yes, I'm not a body. I mean, I always understood that I'm not a body, but I came to the realization that I'm also not male. I'm not female and I'm not male. I have a male body. But there was one very, very strong process that in Path of Love that we did one time, and it became clear that my essence is actually female. I have more of a female essence, and I think that is probably true of many gay people, men and women. Sometimes when I talk to people, I talk about a scale of 1 to 10, and I think all of humanity in their sexuality will fall somewhere on that scale of between 1 and 10. The bisexuals might be right in the middle at 5. They can choose to go this way or that way, depending on who they fall in love with. some gay people, you know, down on the bottom or, you know, say at the beginning at one, they will never be able to be, you know, with a woman, or for girls to be with a man, because their essence is really purely same sex. Whereas at the other end of the scale, at the 10, you know, some men would never, you know, never recoil at the idea of being with another man, and women also. So I think we all fall somewhere on that scale of between 1 and 10. We have male bodies and we have female bodies. Some people, you know, really, you know, can't identify with the body that they're born with. But I have a few gay friends who are also spiritual, also with Osho. And we're very comfortable with our male body, but we still see ourselves in essence as female. At the same time, I have very strong male energy. I'm very comfortable and very at home in my male energy. So I think, you know, we're fluid. Some people more fluid perhaps than others. And I think we just have to look at ourselves and work out, you know, who we are as an individual. And if something that Osho says hits hard, that's where the learning, for me, that's where the deep learning is, because that clearly is an identification. So, you know, if the love is deep enough to the master, the hit that he's giving, you know, with those words, is just an indication of where to start looking at where you're still holding on and where you're holding yourself back in claiming or in thinking that you're this or that. Am I explaining myself clearly?
Absolutely. I mean, this is quite impressive, and to me it shows that you have worked on yourself really hard. And as you said, perhaps because you loved Osho so much, and then he hit you so much, and then really forced you to look inside. I see now from what you're saying that you're very developed. I mean, you're a very developed soul. There is no doubt. I mean, that you're putting things into perspective in a way that goes beyond, you know, you shift the conversation to another level. Almost.
Thank you. I'm glad you understood me.
Osho's work is to make us realize that we are not the body, we are not the mind, and we are something beyond, and that something beyond has no sexuality. It's easy to say, it's easy to understand in words, but I feel like in your case, you actually have searched that, you have experienced that to some extent, which is beautiful.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, it was a strong journey for me to come to that point, but it was great to see that clarity. And now I live from that. I mean, there are many times in my life I would have dropped being gay if it was possible. But, you know, when the energy is so strong, the attraction is so strong to who you're attracted to, you can't repress it. It's impossible to repress. We see what happens in the world with, you know, sexual abuse when, you know, sexual energy is repressed. So, you know, I don't really have a choice. And that's, I think, you know, in this discussion of sexuality that happens a lot in the world, the people don't understand that gay people do not choose to be gay. You know, it's something that you're born with. I had a deep conversation with a psychologist about this one time, and she said some homosexuals are conditioned and they can have that conditioning, you know, reprogrammed. But most are, you know, if you're born that way, you can't change it. It's not possible to change. And this is why Osho hit, you know, monasteries, you know, religions that renounce sex so hard, because some people don't have strong sexual drive and they can drop their sexuality, but others don't. And that's why you get all these Catholic priests who abuse their children that they're teaching and who are given charge, who are, you know, in their charge.
this is topic for another podcast, perhaps. We just need to work on ourselves and spread the light. And I think that's exactly what you're doing. You're definitely spreading light now through this interview.
Thank you. Yes, there's no other choice. You can only work on yourself. Yeah, and through workout, I remember Osho saying one time, I heard him say, the best way to change the world is to change yourself. And I think that, you know, that has been a strong point, you know, that I've taken in my life, that I'm really only interested in changing myself. Yeah. And I was very nervous to, you know, to talk about this with you, but I'm glad that we did. I think it is an important subject, and I think it needs to have some light, you know, shone onto it. So thank you.
I really thank you truly, sincerely, because the way you put things into perspective is such quality and such height and such depth that this is what's needed, in my opinion. And then I think that people who are sensitive and intelligent can relate and understand, and just helping them to do what Osho was trying to do, you know, to break this conditioning and just to work on ourselves. We all have different conditioning. So that's a wonderful message and invitation. We are heading towards the end of the podcast, and I have three final questions for you. So the first one is, what's your morning routine? How does your morning look like in the first couple of hours of your day?
Well, because I'm a traveler, anything can happen. But if I'm settled somewhere, the first thing I do is put on some meditation music in the morning, and that might continue for 2 or 3 hours. I like a quiet morning. If I can manage it, if I'm alone, or if I'm with, you know, somebody who also likes that, then I'll just play meditation music. I'll play Osho, sometimes Muji. And I just stay in a quiet space. Sometimes I'll sit up. Sometimes I'll stay lying down. I really like a quiet, meditative morning.
Second question is, what's your favorite meditation and why?
Well, again, it depends on the circumstances. Obviously, if I'm in a community with a group of people, and we're doing a meditation in a hall, like one of the Osho meditations, chakra breathing is just always has such a strong effect on my body and on my being. Yeah, chakra breathing. But otherwise, just sitting still and, you know, more of a zazen, just sitting and feeling the air, the noises, the turmoil if you're in the marketplace or in a busy restaurant, or just watching. Watching and continuing to watch.
The last question is, you lived the Osho experiment. You were one of the pioneers in this movement of creating a new man, Zorba the Buddha. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today in 2018?
I think an equal quantity of, you know, dance and celebration. I think celebration, dancing, or any kind of expression, celebratory expression, was a very important part of Osho's work. And the insight of silence and stillness, the two joined together. I mean, Zorba, the energy of Zorba and the energy of Buddha combined create the whole man. I think that was his whole point of Zorba the Buddha. So in the world, you know, I love to party, I love to dance, not party, I love to dance. In India, you know, as soon as you play some music, you know, I love to get the people dancing. I've been staying in Buddhist monasteries a little bit this year, and I put on the Bollywood music and get the monks dancing, and they love it. They come alive. I don't feel whole and complete unless I've had at least, you know, some time during the day of stillness and silence. And it can be in the marketplace. It can be sitting in a crowded restaurant. If I'm alone, sitting in a crowded restaurant, just sitting still and allowing the chaos to go around and just being aware of it, but not being involved in it. Yeah. I think Zorba the Buddha is, you know, very relevant in today's world. Yes, absolutely.
It is indeed. It Osho seems like an easy master because everything is allowed. There are no rules, no commandments. You can take sannyas, you can drop sannyas, you do what you want, but then you try to be aware in the marketplace. Off you go.
I mean, with Osho, yes, he gave us all the rope in the world, all of the space in the world to hang ourselves. So really, he's given us, he hasn't taken the responsibility for us. He's given us always the responsibility to do the work and to change ourselves and to find our way. And that's his uniqueness. He didn't burden us. He allowed us to free. But, you know, that freedom, you know, some people misuse that freedom or misuse the responsibility. You know, freedom, you know, has to come with awareness. So the world is a fantastic learning place. As you know, you live in Singapore.
Yes, I'm. I wanted a challenge, and I got a big challenge. I didn't know what I was getting.
You should try driving in India. Well, I've been driving in India the last 6 months, and oh my God.
Well, I have to say that I'm from Rome, and after driving in Rome, that's not really my main challenge. I think living in Singapore, I found it more than driving. I wish I could switch to driving in India.
It's a lot of fun.
It is fun. Well, Parambadi, look, thank you so much for being so brave and being so open and honest and exposing yourself. And I really appreciate. And again, I just want to commend you for being so deep and had such clarity. And it can only be possible because you are an evolved soul and you have worked so much on yourself. And that's the results from the way you speak and the way you talk about this topic, and I think it's incredibly valuable and useful, and I hope and I'm sure that many people will listen to this podcast, maybe even in 10 years, and they will find inspiration from your words. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm glad that you found it useful. I'm sure I'll be quite embarrassed when I listen back to it, but that's another story. Thank you.
Okay. I'll send you a big hug and lots of love, and thank you so much again.
Thank you. I look forward to meeting you one day. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Bye-bye. You're welcome to visit us in Singapore.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Love of Show podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you can show your appreciation by leaving a review on iTunes. Visit lavoshow.com for new episodes, blogs, and much more.